This is Audible.
Harper Audio is pleased to present the complete, unabridged version of Michael Gerber's best-selling book, The E-Myth Revisited, narrated by the author, Michael Gerber. A worldwide business classic, a stunningly insightful view into why most small businesses don't work and what you can do about it. Discover Michael Gerber's secrets to making your business work for you. And now, Michael Gerber.
The E-Myth Revisited, Why Most Small Businesses Don't Work and What to Do About It. Introduction. I think that maybe inside any business there was someone slowly going crazy. Joseph Heller, Something Happened. If you own a small business, or if you want to own a small business, this book was written for you. It represents many thousands of hours of work we have done at E-Myth Worldwide over the past 24 years. It illustrates a belief created and supported by the experiences we have had with the thousands of small business owners with whom we've worked. It is a belief that says small businesses in the United States simply do not work. The people who own them do. And what we have also discovered is that the people who own small businesses in this country work far more than they should for the return they're getting. Indeed, the problem is not that the owners of small businesses in this country don't work. The problem is that they're doing the wrong work. As a result, most of their businesses end up in chaos, unmanageable, unpredictable, and unrewarding. Just look at the numbers. Businesses start and fail in the United States at an increasingly staggering rate. Every year, over 1 million people in this country start a business of some sort. Statistics tell us that by the end of the first year, at least 40% of them will be out of business. Within 5 years, more than 80% of them, 800,000, will have failed. And the rest of the bad news is, if you own a small business that has managed to survive for 5 years or more, don't breathe a sigh of relief. Because more than 80% of the small businesses that survive the first 5 years fail in the second five. Why is this? Why do so many people go into business only to fail? What lesson aren't they learning? Why is it that with all the information available today on how to be successful in small business, so few people really are? This book answers those questions. It's about four profound ideas, which if you understand and take them to heart, will give you the power to create an extraordinarily exciting and personally rewarding small business. Ignore them, and you will likely join the hundreds of thousands of people every year who pour their energy and capital and life into starting a small business and fail, or the many others who struggle along for years simply trying to survive. Idea number one. There is a myth in this country. I call it the E-Myth, which says that small businesses are started by entrepreneurs risking capital to make a profit. This is simply not so. The real reasons people start businesses have little to do with entrepreneurship. In fact, this belief in the entrepreneurial myth is the most important factor in the devastating rate of small business failure today. Understanding the E-Myth and applying that understanding to the creation and development of a small business can be the secret to any business's success. Idea number two. There's a revolution going on today in American small business. I call it the turnkey revolution. Not only is it changing the way we do business in this country and throughout the world, but it is changing who goes into business, how they do it, and the likelihood of their survival. Idea number three. At the heart of the turnkey revolution is a dynamic process we at eMyth Worldwide call the business development process. When it is systematized and applied purposely by a small business owner, the business development process has the power to transform any small business into an incredibly effective organization. Our experience has shown us that when a small business incorporates this process into its every activity and uses it to control its destiny, that company stays young and thrives. When a small business ignores this process, as most unfortunately do, it commits itself to management by luck, stagnation, and ultimately failure. The consequences are inevitable. Idea number four. The business development process can be systematically applied by any small business owner in a step-by-step method that incorporates the lessons of the turnkey revolution into the operation of that business. This process then becomes a predictable way to produce results and vitality in any small business whose owner is willing to give it the time and attention it requires to flourish. Since the founding of eMyth Worldwide in 1977, we have assisted over 25,000 small business owners with the implementation of our business development process through their enrollment in our unique eMyth Mastery program, and I have seen it succeed thousands of times. I would venture to guess that no organization has had more direct experience applying the lessons of the turnkey revolution and the business development process to the development of a small business than we have at eMyth Worldwide. And while the process is no magic bullet and does require hard work, it is also gratifying work and the only work I know that will give you the level of control you need to get what you want from your small business. Indeed, it will change your business and it will change your life. This book, then, is about producing results, not simply how to do it, because both of us know that books like that don't work. People do. And what makes people work is an idea worth working for, along with a clear understanding of what needs to be done. It is only when such an idea becomes firmly integrated into the way you think and operate your business that how to do it becomes meaningful. This book is about such an idea that says your business is nothing more than a distinct reflection of who you are. If your thinking is sloppy, your business will be sloppy. If you are disorganized, your business will be disorganized. If you are greedy, your employees will be greedy, giving you less and less of themselves and always asking for more. If your information about what needs to be done in your business is limited, your business will reflect that limitation. So if your business is to change, as it must continuously to thrive, you must change first. If you are unwilling to change, your business will never be capable of giving you what you want. The first change that needs to take place has to do with your idea of what a business really is and what it takes to make one work. Once you fully understand the relationship every owner must have with his or her business, if it is to work, I can assure you that your business and your life will take on new vitality and new meaning. You'll know why so many people fail to get what they want from a business of their own. You'll see the almost magical opportunities available to anyone who starts a small business in the right way, with a true understanding, with the necessary tools. I've seen it happen thousands of times in every kind of business imaginable with people who knew nothing about business when they started. My wish is that by the time you're through listening to this book, it will have started to happen to you. Part 1. E-Myth and American Small Business. Chapter 1. The Entrepreneurial Myth. They intoxicate themselves with work, so they won't see how they really are. Aldous Huxley. The E-Myth is the myth of the entrepreneur. It runs deep in this country and rings of the heroic. Picture the typical entrepreneur, and Herculean pictures come to mind, a man or woman standing alone, windblown against the elements, bravely defying insurmountable odds, climbing sheer faces of treacherous rock, all to realize the dream of creating a business of one's own. The legend reeks of nobility, of lofty, extra-human efforts, of a prodigious commitment to larger-than-life ideals. Well, while there are such people, my experience tells me they're rare. Of the thousands of business people I've had the opportunity to know and work with over the past two decades, few were real entrepreneurs when I met them. The vision was all but gone in most. The zest for the climb had turned into a terror of heights. The face of the rock had become something to cling to rather than to scale. Exhaustion was common, exhilaration rare. But hadn't all of them once been entrepreneurs? After all, they'd started their own business. There must have been some dream that drove them to take such a risk. But if so, where was the dream now? Why had it faded? Where was the entrepreneur who'd started the business? The answer is simple. The entrepreneur had only existed for a moment, a fleeting second in time, and then it was gone, in most cases, forever. If the entrepreneur survived at all, it was only as a myth that grew out of a misunderstanding about who goes into business and why. A misunderstanding that has cost us dearly in this country, more than we can possibly imagine, in lost resources, lost opportunities, and wasted lives. That myth, that misunderstanding, I call the E-Myth, the myth of the entrepreneur. And it finds its roots in this country in a romantic belief that small businesses are started by entrepreneurs, when in fact, most are not. Then who does start a small business in America, and why? The entrepreneurial seizure. To understand the E-Myth and the misunderstanding at its core, let's take a closer look at the person who goes into business. Not after he goes into business, but before. For that matter, where were you before you started your business? And if you're thinking about going into business, where are you now? Well, if you're like most of the people I've known, you were working for somebody else. What were you doing? Probably technical work, like almost everybody who goes into business. You were a carpenter, a mechanic, or a machinist. You were a bookkeeper or a poodle clipper, a draftsperson or a hairdresser, a barber or a computer programmer, a doctor or a technical writer, a graphic artist or an accountant, an interior designer or a plumber or a salesperson. But whatever you were doing technical work. And you were probably damn good at it. But you were doing it for somebody else. Then, one day, for no apparent reason, something happened. It might have been the weather, a birthday, or your child's graduation from high school. It might have been the paycheck you received on a Friday afternoon, or a sideways glance from the boss that just didn't sit right. It might have been a feeling that your boss didn't really appreciate your contribution to the success of his business. It could have been anything, it doesn't matter what, but one day, for apparently no reason, you were suddenly stricken with an entrepreneurial seizure, and from that day on your life was never to be the same. Inside your mind it sounded something like this. What am I doing this for? Why am I working for this guy? Hell, I know as much about the business as he does. If it weren't for me, he wouldn't have a business. Any dummy can run a business. I'm working for one. And the moment you paid attention to what you were saying and really took it to heart, your fate was sealed. The excitement of cutting the cord became your constant companion. The thought of independence followed you everywhere. The idea of being your own boss, doing your own thing, singing your own song, became obsessively irresistible. Once you were stricken with an entrepreneurial seizure, there was no relief. You couldn't get rid of it. You had to start your own business. The fatal assumption. In the throes of your entrepreneurial seizure, you fell victim to the most disastrous assumption anyone can make about going into business. It's an assumption made by all technicians who go into business for themselves, one that charts the course of a business from grand opening to liquidation the moment it is made. That fatal assumption is, if you understand the technical work of a business, you understand a business that does that technical work. And the reason it's fatal is that it just isn't true. In fact, it's the root cause of most small business failures. The technical work of a business and a business that does that technical work are two totally different things. But the technician who starts a business fails to see this. To the technician suffering from an entrepreneurial seizure, a business is not a business, but a place to go to work. So the carpenter, or the electrician, or the plumber becomes a contractor. The barber opens up a barber shop. The technical writer starts a technical writing business. The hairdresser starts a beauty salon. The engineer goes into the semiconductor business. The musician opens up a music store. All of them believing that by understanding the technical work of the business, they are immediately and eminently qualified to run a business that does that kind of work. And it's simply not true. In fact, rather than being their greatest single asset, knowing the technical work of their business becomes their greatest single liability. For if the technician didn't know how to do the technical work of the business, he would have to learn how to get it done. He would be forced to learn how to make the business work rather than to do the work himself. The real tragedy is that when the technician falls prey to the fatal assumption, the business that was supposed to free him from the limitations of working for somebody else actually enslaves him. Suddenly, the job he knew how to do so well becomes one job he knows how to do, plus a dozen others he doesn't know how to do at all. Because although the entrepreneurial seizure started the business, it's the technician who goes to work. And suddenly, an entrepreneurial dream turns into a technician's nightmare. See the young woman baking pies. See the young woman start a business baking pies. See the young woman become an old woman. I met Sarah after she'd been in business for 3 years. She told me they have been the longest 3 years of my life. Sarah's business was named All About Pies, not its real name. But in truth, Sarah's business wasn't really all about pies. It was really all about work. The work Sarah did. The work Sarah used to love to do more than anything else. Plus the work Sarah had never done in her life. In fact, Sarah told me, not only do I hate to do all this, she spread her arms, taking in the small shop in which we stood, but I hate, she emphasized the word almost fiercely, I hate baking pies. I can't stand the thought of pies. I can't stand the smell of pies. I can't stand the sight of pies. And then she started crying. The sweet, fresh aroma of pies filled the air. It was 7 a.m., and all about pies was to open in 30 minutes. But Sarah's mind was someplace else. It's 7 o'clock, she said, wiping her eyes with her apron as though reading my mind. Do you realize I've been here since 3 o'clock this morning, and that I was up at 2 to get ready, and that by the time I get the pies ready, open for business, take care of my customers, clean up, close up, do the shopping, reconcile the cash register, go to the bank, have dinner, and get the pies ready for tomorrow's bake. It'll be 9:30 or 10 o'clock tonight, and by the time I do all that, by the time any normal person, for God's sake, would say that the day was done, I will then also need to sit down and begin to figure out how I'm going to pay the rent next month. And all this, she spread her arms wearily again as though to accentuate everything she'd just said, because my very best friends told me I was crazy not to open a pie shop because I was so damn good at it. And what's worse, I believed them. I saw a way out of the horrible job I used to have. I saw a way to get free, doing work I loved to do, and doing it all for me. She was on a tear that I didn't want to interrupt. I waited quietly to hear what she would say next. Instead, she kicked the huge black oven in front of her with her right foot. Damn, she exploded. Damn, damn, damn. For emphasis, she kicked the oven again, and then slumped, sighed deeply, and hugged herself almost desperately. What do I do now? She said, almost in a whisper. Not really asking me, I knew, but asking herself. Sarah leaned against the wall and remained there quietly for a long moment, staring at her feet. The large clock in the wall ticked loudly in the empty shop. I could hear the cars driving by on the busy street in front of the shop as the city came awake. The sun shone harshly through the spotless windows, sweeping the gleaming oak floor in front of the counter. I could see the dust in the stream of light hanging suspended as though waiting for Sarah to speak. She was deep in debt. She had spent everything she had and more to create this lovely little shop. The floors were the best oak. The ovens were the best ovens. The displays were charming, the very best money could buy. She had put her heart into this place, just as she had put her heart into her pies, falling in love with baking as a young girl, mentored by her aunt who had lived with her family while Sarah was growing up. Her aunt had filled her family's kitchen, Sarah's childhood, with the delicious sweet aroma of freshly baked pies. Her aunt had introduced her to the magic of the process, the kneading of the dough, the cleaning of the oven, the sprinkling of the flour, the preparation of the trays, the careful cutting of the apples, the cherries, the rhubarb, the peaches. It was a labor of love. Her aunt had corrected her when, in her haste, Sarah had hurried the process. Her aunt had told her time and time again, Sarah, dear, we have all the time in the world. Baking pies is not about getting done. It's about baking pies. And Sarah thought she understood her. But now Sarah knew that baking pies was all about getting done. Baking pies was ruin for her, at least she thought it was. The clock continued its emphatic ticking. I watched as Sarah seemed to shrink even closer to herself. I knew how oppressive it must be for her to find herself so deeply in debt, to feel so helpless in the face of it. Where was her aunt now? Who was going to teach her what to do next? Sarah, I said as carefully as I could, it's time to learn all about pies, all over again. The technician suffering from an entrepreneurial seizure takes the work he loves to do and turns it into a job. The work that was born out of love becomes a chore among a welter of other less familiar and less pleasant chores. Rather than maintaining its specialness, representing the unique skill the technician possesses and upon which he started the business, the work becomes trivialized, something to get through in order to make room for everything else that must be done. I told Sarah that every technician suffering from an entrepreneurial seizure experiences exactly the same thing. First, exhilaration. Second, terror. Third, exhaustion. And finally, despair. A terrible sense of loss, not only the loss of what was closest to them, their special relationship with their work, but the loss of purpose, the loss of self. Sarah looked at me with a sense of relief, as though she felt seen, but not judged. "You've got my number," she said. "But what do I do now?" "You take this one step at a time," I answered. "The technician isn't the only problem you've got to deal with here." Chapter 2, The Entrepreneur, the Manager, and the Technician. Thus in the course of his life, one man acquires many personal qualities, many personages, many eyes, because each, speaking for itself independently of the others, says I, me, when it appears. Jean Vesey, Toward Awakening. No, the technician isn't the only problem. The problem is more complicated than that. The problem is that everybody who goes into business is actually three people in one, the entrepreneur, the manager, and the technician. And the problem is compounded by the fact that while each of these personalities wants to be the boss, none of them wants to have a boss. So they start a business together in order to get rid of the boss, and the conflict begins. To show you how the problem manifests itself in all of us, let's examine the way our various internal personalities interact. Let's take a look at two personalities we're all familiar with, the fat guy and the skinny guy. Have you ever decided to go on a diet? You're sitting in front of the television set one Saturday afternoon, watching an athletic competition, awed by the athlete's stamina and dexterity. You're eating a sandwich, your second since you sat down to watch the event 2 hours before. You're feeling sluggish in the face of all the action on the screen when suddenly somebody wakes up in you and says, "What are you doing? Look at yourself. You're fat. You're out of shape. Do something about it." It's happened to us all. Somebody wakes up inside us with a totally different picture of who we should be and what we should be doing. In this case, let's call him the skinny guy. Who's the skinny guy? He's the one who uses words like discipline, exercise, organization. The skinny guy is insolent, self-righteous, a stickler for detail, a compulsive tyrant. The skinny guy abhors fat people, can't stand sitting around, needs to be on the move, lives for action. The skinny guy has just taken over. Watch out. Things are about to change. Before you know it, you're cleaning all the fattening foods out of the refrigerator. You're buying a new pair of running shoes, barbells, and sweats. Things are going to be different around here. You have a new lease on life. You plan your new physical regimen. Up at 5, run 3 miles. Cold shower at 6. A breakfast of wheat toast, black coffee, and half a grapefruit. Then ride your bicycle to work. Home by 7. Run another 2 miles. To bed at 10. The world's already a different place. And you actually pull it off. By Monday night, you've lost 2 pounds. You go to sleep dreaming of winning the Boston Marathon. Why not? The way things are going, it's only a matter of time. Tuesday night, you get on the scale. Another pound gone. You're incredible, gorgeous, a lean machine. On Wednesday, you really pour it on. You work out an extra hour in the morning, an extra half hour at night. You can't wait to get on the scale. You strip down to your bare skin, shivering in the bathroom, filled with expectation of what your scale is going to tell you. You step lightly onto it and look down. What you see is nothing. You haven't lost an ounce. You're exactly the same as you were on Tuesday. Dejection creeps in. You begin to feel a slight twinge of resentment. After all that work, after all that sweat and effort, and then nothing? It isn't fair. But you shrug it off. After all, tomorrow's another day. You go to bed vowing to work harder on Thursday, but somehow something has changed. You don't know what's changed until Thursday morning. It's raining. The room is cold. Something feels different. What is it? For a minute or two, you can't quite put your finger on it. And then you get it. Somebody else is in your body. It's the fat guy. He's back. And he doesn't want to run. As a matter of fact, he doesn't even want to get out of bed. It's cold outside. Run? Are you kidding me? The fat guy doesn't want anything to do with it. The only exercise he might be interested in is eating. And all of a sudden, you find yourself in front of the refrigerator, inside the refrigerator, all over the kitchen. Food is now your major interest. The marathon is gone. The lean machine is gone. The sweats and barbells and running shoes are gone. The fat guy is back. He's running the show again. It happens to all of us time and time again because we've been deluded into thinking we're really one person. And so when the skinny guy decides to change things, we actually believe that it's I who's making that decision. And when the fat guy wakes up and changes it all back again, we think it's I who's making that decision too. But it isn't. It's we. The skinny guy and the fat guy are two totally different personalities with different needs, different interests, and different lifestyles. That's why they don't like each other. They each want totally different things. The problem is that when you're the skinny guy, you're totally consumed by his needs, his interests, his lifestyle. And then something happens. The scale disappoints you. The weather turns cold. Somebody offers you a ham sandwich. At that moment, the fat guy, who's been waiting in the wings all this time, grabs your attention, grabs control. You're him again. In other words, when you're the skinny guy, you're always making promises for the fat guy to keep. And when you're the fat guy, you're always making promises for the skinny guy to keep. Is it any wonder we have such a tough time keeping our commitments to ourselves? It's not that we're indecisive or unreliable. It's that each and every one of us is a whole set of different personalities, each with his own interests and way of doing things. Asking any one of them to defer to any one of the others is inviting a battle or even a full-scale war. Anyone who's ever experienced the conflict between the fat guy and the skinny guy, and haven't we all, knows what I mean. You can't be both. One of them has to lose, and they both know it. Well, that's the kind of war going on inside the owner of every small business. But it's a three-way battle between the entrepreneur, the manager, and the technician. Unfortunately, it's a battle no one can win. Understanding the differences between them will quickly explain why. The entrepreneur. The entrepreneurial personality turns the most trivial condition into an exceptional opportunity. The entrepreneur is the visionary in us, the dreamer, the energy behind every human activity, the imagination that sparks the fire of the future, the catalyst for change. The entrepreneur lives in the future, never in the past, rarely in the present. He's happiest when left free to construct images of what if and if when. In science, the entrepreneurial personality works in the most abstract and least pragmatic areas of particle physics, pure mathematics, and theoretical astronomy. In art, it thrives in the rarefied arena of the avant-garde. In business, the entrepreneur is the innovator, the grand strategist, the creator of new methods for penetrating or creating new markets, the world-bending giant like Sears Roebuck, Henry Ford, Tom Watson of IBM, and Ray Kroc of McDonald's. The entrepreneur is our creative personality, always at its best dealing with the unknown, prodding the future, creating probabilities out of possibilities, engineering chaos into harmony. Every strong entrepreneurial personality has an extraordinary need for control. Living as he does in the visionary world of the future, he needs control of people and events in the present so that he can concentrate on his dreams. Given his need for change, the entrepreneur creates a great deal of havoc around him, which is predictably unsettling for those he enlists in his projects. As a result, he often finds himself rapidly outdistancing the others. The farther ahead he is, the greater the effort required to pull his cohorts along. This, then, becomes the entrepreneurial worldview. A world made up both of an overabundance of opportunities and dragging feet. The problem is, how could he pursue the opportunities without getting mired down by the feet? The way he usually chooses is to bully, harass, excoriate, flatter, cajole, scream, and finally, when all else fails, promise whatever he must to keep the project moving. To the entrepreneur, most people are problems that get in the way of the dream. The manager. The managerial personality is pragmatic. Without the manager, there would be no planning, no order, no predictability. The manager is the part of us that goes to Sears and buys stacking plastic boxes, takes them back to the garage, and systematically stores all the various sized nuts, bolts, and screws in their own carefully identified drawer. He then hangs all of the tools in impeccable order on the walls, lawn tools on one wall, carpentry tools on another, and to be absolutely certain that order is not disturbed, paints a picture of each tool on the wall where it hangs. If the entrepreneur lives in the future, the manager lives in the past. Where the entrepreneur craves control, the manager craves order. Where the entrepreneur thrives on change, the manager compulsively clings to the status quo. Where the entrepreneur invariably sees the opportunity in events, the manager invariably sees the problems. The manager builds a house and then lives in it forever. The entrepreneur builds a house and the instant it's done, begins planning the next one. The manager creates neat, orderly rows of things. The entrepreneur creates the things the manager puts into rows. The manager is the one who runs after the entrepreneur to clean up the mess. Without the entrepreneur, there would be no mess to clean up. Without the manager, there could be no business, no society. Without the entrepreneur, there would be no innovation. It is the tension between the entrepreneur's vision and the manager's pragmatism that creates the synthesis from which all great works are born. The technician. The technician is the doer. If you want it done right, do it yourself is the technician's credo. The technician loves to tinker. Things are to be taken apart and put back together again. Things aren't supposed to be dreamed about. They're supposed to be done. If the entrepreneur lives in the future and the manager lives in the past, the technician lives in the present. He loves the feel of things and the fact that things can get done. As long as the technician is working, he is happy, but only on one thing at a time. He knows that two things can't get done simultaneously. Only a fool would try. So he works steadily and is happiest when he is in control of the workflow. As a result, the technician mistrusts those he works for because they're always trying to get more work done than is either possible or necessary. To the technician, thinking is unproductive unless it's thinking about the work that needs to be done. As a result, he's suspicious of lofty ideas or abstractions. Thinking isn't work. It gets in the way of work. The technician isn't interested in ideas. He's interested in how to do it. To the technician, all ideas need to be reduced to methodology if they're to be of any value, and with good reason. The technician knows that if it weren't for him, the world would be in more trouble than it already is. Nothing would get done, but lots of people would be thinking about it. Put another way, while the entrepreneur dreams, the manager frets, and the technician ruminates. The technician is a resolute individualist, standing his ground, producing today's bread to eat at tonight's dinner. He's the backbone of every cultural tradition, but most importantly, of ours. If the technician didn't do it, it wouldn't get done. Everyone gets in the technician's way. The entrepreneur is always throwing a monkey wrench into his day with the creation of yet another great new idea. On the other hand, the entrepreneur is always creating new and interesting work for the technician to do, thus establishing a potentially symbiotic relationship. Unfortunately, it rarely works out that way. Since most entrepreneurial ideas don't work in the real world, the technician's usual experience is one of frustration and annoyance at being interrupted in the course of doing what needs to be done to try something new that probably doesn't need to be done at all. The manager is also a problem to the technician, because he is determined to impose order on the technician's work, to reduce him to a part of the system. But being a rugged individualist, the technician can't stand being treated that way. To the technician, the system is dehumanizing, cold, antiseptic, and impersonal. It violates his individuality. Work is what a person does, and to the degree that it's not, work becomes something foreign. To the manager, however, work is a system of results in which the technician is but a component part. To the manager, then, the technician becomes a problem to be managed. To the technician, the manager becomes a meddler to be avoided. To both of them, the entrepreneur is the one who got them into trouble in the first place. The fact of the matter is that we all have an entrepreneur, manager, and technician inside us. And if they were equally balanced, we'd be describing an incredibly competent individual. The entrepreneur would be free to forge ahead into new areas of interest. The manager would be solidifying the base of operations, and the technician would be doing the technical work. Each would derive satisfaction from the work he does best, serving the whole in the most productive way. Unfortunately, our experience shows us that few people who go into business are blessed with such a balance. Instead, the typical small business owner is only 10% entrepreneur, 20% manager, and 70% technician. The entrepreneur wakes up with a vision. The manager screams, "Oh, no!" And while the two of them are battling it out, the technician seizes the opportunity to go into business for himself. Not to pursue the entrepreneurial dream, however, but to finally wrest control of his work from the other two. To the technician, it's a dream come true. The boss is dead. But to the business, it's a disaster, because the wrong person is at the helm. The technician is in charge. Sarah looked a little overwhelmed. "I don't understand," she said. "How could I have done this differently? The only reason I went into this business was because I loved baking pies. If it hadn't been for that, what would have been the point?" She watched my face suspiciously, as though I were trying to make her already impossible situation even more impossible. "Well, let's think about it together," I answered. "If it's true that within each business person there are three personalities rather than just one, can you imagine what a mess that makes? If one of you wants this, and another of you wants that, and a third wants something entirely different, can you imagine the confusion that causes in our lives? And it's not only the personalities inside each and every one of us that confuse us, but all the others we come into contact with as well. In our customers, in our employees, in our children, in our partners, in our parents, in our friends, in our spouses, in our lovers. If this is true, and all you need to do to discover whether it is or not is to take a look at yourself from day to day, as though from above, as though from outside of your skin, as though you were watching someone else, that is, to observe yourself as you go through the day, you would see the different parts come out. You would see them playing their respective games. You would see how they fight for their own space and the space of all the others, and sabotage each other as best they can. In your business, you would see how one part of you craves a sense of order, while another part of you dreams about the future. You would see how another part of you can't stand being idle and jumps in to bake and to clean up and to wait on customers, the part of you who feels guilty if she isn't doing something all the time. In short, you would see how the entrepreneur in you dreams and schemes. The manager in you is constantly attempting to keep things as they are, and the technician in you drives the other two crazy. You would see that it not only matters that your personalities are not in a balanced relationship with each other, but that your life depends on gaining that balance. That until you do, it's a war. And it's a war no one can win. You would also see that one of your personalities is the strongest of the three, or four, or five, or six, and that she always manages to control the others. In fact, if you watch long enough, you'll begin to understand how devastating the tyranny of your strongest personality is to your life. And you'll see that without balance, without all three of these personalities being given the opportunity, the freedom, the nourishment they each need to grow, your business cannot help but mirror your own lopsidedness. So it is that an entrepreneurial business without a manager to give it order and without a technician to put it to work is doomed to suffer an early and probably very dramatic death. And that a manager-driven business, without an entrepreneur or a technician to play their absolutely critical roles, will put things into little gray boxes over and over again, only to realize too late that there's no reason for the things or the boxes she puts them into. Such a business will die very neatly. And that in a technician-driven business, without the entrepreneur to lead her and the manager to supervise her, the technician will work until she drops, only to wake up the next morning to go to work even harder, and the next, only to discover, long after it's too late, that while she was working, someone moved a freeway through the store. Sarah looked at me with uncertainty. "But I'm not an entrepreneur," she said. "All I do is bake pies. All I ever wanted to do was to bake pies, just like the technician you described. What entrepreneurial personalities were passed out, I think I got passed over. What do I do if there is no entrepreneur in me?" I couldn't help but smile. This was going to be fun, because I knew when Sarah finally got it, and I knew she would, she was going to discover someone in herself she never knew was there. Before we reach that conclusion, Sarah, let's look more closely at what an entrepreneur does, I responded. An entrepreneur does the work of envisioning the business as something apart from you, the owner. The work of asking all the right questions about why this business as opposed to that business. Why a pie-baking business rather than a body shop? If you're a baker of pies, it's easy for you to decide upon opening a pie-baking business, but that's just the point. If you're a baker of pies and are determined to do entrepreneurial work, you would leave your pie-baking experience behind you and engage in the internal dialogue with which every truly entrepreneurial personality is wonderfully familiar. You would begin to say to yourself, "It's time for me to create a new life. It's time for me to challenge my imagination and to begin the process of shaping an entirely new life." And the best way to do that anywhere in this whole wide world of opportunity is to create an exciting new business, one that can give me everything that I want, one that doesn't require me to be there all the time, one that has the potential to be stunningly unique, one that people will talk about long after having shopped in it the very first time, and as a result of that delightful experience, will come back to shop there again because it has such a special flavor to it. I wonder what that business would be. I wonder what that business would be, I said to Sarah, is the truly entrepreneurial question. The dreaming question, I call it. It's the question that's at the heart of the work of an entrepreneur. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder. So the work of an entrepreneur is to wonder, I continued, to imagine and to dream, to see with as much of herself as she can muster the possibilities that waft about in midair, someplace above there, above your head and within your heart. Not in the past, but in the future. That's the work the entrepreneurial personality does at the outset of her business and at each and every stage along the way. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder. Just as every inventor must, just as every composer must, just as every artist or every craftsperson or every physicist must, just as every baker of pies must. I call it future work. I wonder is the true work of the entrepreneurial personality. She tried to repress it, but I saw a small smile begin to form on Sarah's mouth. How could I do this differently? She finally asked me with growing confidence. If I were to give the true entrepreneur in myself life, how could I totally change my experience of this business? Now you've got it, I said. That's just the right question. And to get to the answer, let's look at where your business exists today in the small business life cycle. Chapter 3. Infancy, the technician's phase. My Uncle Sol had a skunk farm, but the skunks caught cold and died, and so my Uncle Sol imitated the skunks in a subtle manner. E.E. Cummings, Collected Poems. It is self-evident that businesses, like people, are supposed to grow, and with growth comes change. Unfortunately, most businesses are not run according to this principle. Instead, most businesses are operating according to what the owner wants as opposed to what the business needs. And what the technician who runs the company wants is not growth or change, but exactly the opposite. He wants a place to go to work, free to do what he wants, when he wants, free from the constraints of working for the boss. Unfortunately, what the technician wants dooms his business before it even begins. To understand why, let's take a look at the three phases of a business's growth: infancy, adolescence, and maturity. Understanding each phase and what goes on in the business owner's mind during each of them is critical to discovering why most small businesses don't thrive and ensuring that yours does. The boss is dead, and you, the technician, are free at last. Finally, you can do your own thing in your own business. Hope runs high. The air is electric with possibilities. It's like being let out of school for the summer. Your newfound freedom is intoxicating. In the beginning, nothing is too much for your business to ask. As the technician, you're accustomed to paying your dues, so the hours devoted to the business during infancy are not spent grudgingly, but optimistically. There's work to be done, and that's what you're all about. After all, your middle name is work. Besides, you think, this work is for me. And so you work 10, 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. Even when you're at home, you're at work. All your thoughts, all your feelings revolve around your new business. You can't get it out of your mind. You're consumed by it, totally invested in doing whatever is necessary to keep it alive. But now you're doing not only the work you know how to do, but the work you don't know how to do as well. You're not only making it, but you're also buying it, selling it, and shipping it. During infancy, you're a master juggler keeping all the balls in the air. It's easy to spot a business in infancy. The owner and the business are one and the same thing. If you remove the owner from an infancy business, there would be no business left. It would disappear. In infancy, you are the business. It's even named after you. Joe's Place, Tommy's Joint, Mary's Fine Foods, so the customer won't forget you're the boss. And soon, if you're lucky, all of the sweat, worry, and work begin to pay off. You're good. You work hard. The customers don't forget. They're coming back. They're sending in friends. Their friends have friends. And they're all talking about Joe, Tommy, and Mary. They're all talking about you. If you can believe what your customers are saying, there's never been anyone like Joe, Tom, and Mary. Joe, Tom, and Mary are just like old friends. They work hard for their money, and they do good work. Joe is the best barber I ever went to. Tommy is the best printer I ever used. Mary makes the best corned beef sandwich I ever ate. Your customers are crazy about you. They keep coming in droves. And you love it. But then it changes. Subtly at first, but gradually it becomes obvious. You're falling behind. There's more work to do than you can possibly get done. The customers are relentless. They want you. They need you. You've spoiled them for anyone else. You're working at breakneck speed. And then the inevitable happens. You, the master juggler, begin to drop some of the balls. It can't be helped. No matter how hard you try, you simply can't catch them all. Your enthusiasm for working with the customers wanes. Deliveries once early are now late. The product begins to show the wear and tear. Nothing seems to work the way it did at first. Joe's haircuts don't look the way they used to. I said short in the back, not on the sides. My name's not Fred, that's my brother, and I never had a crew cut. Glitches start showing up in Tommy's printing. Typos, ink smudges, wrong colors, wrong paper. I didn't order business cards, I ordered catalog covers. Pink? I said brown. Mary's best-tasting, biggest stack of corned beef in the world suddenly looks like pastrami. It is pastrami. Didn't you ask for pastrami? Another irritated voice calls out. Where's my pastrami sandwich? This is corned beef. And yet another. What are these garbanzo beans doing in my meatloaf? What do? You stretch. You work harder. You put in more time, more energy. If you put in 12 hours before, you now put in 14. If you put in 14 hours before, you now put in 16. If you put in 16 hours before, you now put in 20. But the balls keep dropping. All of a sudden, Joe, Tommy, and Mary wish their names weren't on the sign.